I'm supposed to talk today about Thomas Aquinas. We've skipped quite a few years. We ended with the death of Aristotle in 322 BC. Thomas Aquinas was born in 1225, which is quite a number of years from 322 BC. There are some accounts that have him being born in 1224 or 1226, but 1225, I think, is the usually is the most frequent date, and the date of his death is there's no controversy. That was March 7, 1274. Thomas Aquinas was the son of an Italian knight, and he lived in a place called Rocca Secca in Italy, and he attended the University of Naples, which was had been organized by the great emperor Frederick II, the famous wonder of the world, the Stupor Mundi, and he was, as you know, was involved in all sorts of fights with the papacy. People in Thomas Aquinas's family were involved in these fights. First, some of his older brothers had fought first for the emperor, and then they shifted against him, and I think one of his brothers was executed by the emperor. But Thomas Aquinas never mentions the emperor, the Holy Roman Empire, in his discussion of politics. He tends not at all to comment on current events. If someone were just looking at what Aquinas wrote, he wouldn't be able to get any idea at all of what was going on in the Middle Ages. Aquinas is much more interested in more general ideas than descriptions or reactions to particular events of his time. Aquinas decided to join the Dominican order, which was fairly new at the time. Dominican order was an order of friars. These are people who are like monks in the sense they take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience to their superiors, but they don't live as monks do in special places. They're separate from the world. They travel from place to place, preaching and begging. The Dominican order was an order of preachers. They were the first order founded specifically for preaching. So Aquinas was very attracted to this order and he joined it. But his family didn't like the idea of his joining the order because that wasn't a very high status. They approved of him going into the church, but they had in mind that he would be appointed to some very high office, such as the abbot of the Monte Cassino Abbey, which was near where they lived, and they had the necessary connections to get him that post, but he wasn't interested. So the family got permission of the emperor to seize him. He was, I think, coming through on a trip to Tuscany. They seized him, and he was imprisoned in the family castle for about a year. He took the time when he was it wasn't really imprisonment. He was able to tutor his sisters and receive friends and visitors. But he took the time to study. Among other things he did then was he memorized the Latin Bible and also the commentary, the sentences of Peter Lombard, which was an enormously long theological work. He had an amazing memory, so he when he wrote, he could always refer to different sources and have quotations without that he just had learned. But eventually the family let him go, and he continued his work in the Dominican order throughout his life. He studied with Albert the Great, Albertus Magnus, and he then taught at various places, including most especially University of Paris, he was offered various important jobs in the church, such as the Pope. One of the popes wanted to make him Archbishop of Naples, and he was also offered he could become abbot of Monte Cassino, even though he was remaining as Dominican, but he turned those down. He was an amazingly productive writer. He was, I'm sure he wrote the most of any of the people I'll be talking about. In the approximately 25 years that he was active as a writer, he wrote about 8.5 million words. His method of writing was that he would dictate to a secretary. He would just compose it, just orally dictating to the secretary. Sometimes he would have several secretaries, and he'd be dictating different books or different works to them at the same time. And so capable of intense concentration. He would sometimes concentrate on a problem so much that even a conversation, he would appear to be going into a trance, and he wouldn't notice what was happening. There was one account that he was, there was some very important official in the church who was visiting the Dominican priory that he was staying, and they introduced him to Aquinas, and Aquinas really didn't take any notice. He just seemed to be mumbling to himself. So the ecclesiastical official thought he was being rude, and he was going to tell him off. Before he could do it, one of the other friars noticed what was happening, and he nudged Aquinas, started shaking him a bit, and then he came out of the trance, and then he was very polite to the person. They explained what had happened. He was also very good friends with King Louis the Ninth of France, who had a very high opinion of him. Saint Louis the Ninth. That he was the person that the city of St. Louis is named for. So that's King Louis the Ninth. One other detail about Aquinas: not only was he probably the philosopher who wrote more than any of the other great philosophers, he was also the fattest of the great philosophers. He was enormously fat. In fact, one of the stories is when he would celebrate Mass and kneel at the altar, they had to cut out a part of the altar in front of him so he would be able to fit in. I think David Hume was probably second fattest to Aquinas, but Aquinas holds the record. As I say, in Aquinas's comments on politics, ethics are not concerned very much with contemporary events. That the principal writings of Aquinas on politics. Or first, what it was in the reading list is given as a treatise on law. This is a certain questions in his main, most important philosophical work called Summa Theologica. In the treatise on law is the Summa is organized in different parts, which are divided into further parts. So this treatise on law is the first part of the second part, questions 90 through 108. It's called the Prima Secundae. And the other important, short work he wrote on politics is something called On Kingship, De Regno. This is dated about 1268. There's some controversy on whether he actually wrote it or was written by one of his followers, but the usual opinion is that he did write it. Now, I'll just mention something on the way the Summa Theologica is organized. What Aquinas generally does when he considers wants to give his views on a philosophical question is he'll first say he'll give the denial of the proposition he wants to defend. For example, one of the famous articles where he wants to prove that God exists, he starts off, it said, it would seem that God does not exist. Then, after that, he lists a whole series of reasons for upholding the thesis that he wants to deny. He would give all sorts of reasons why, say, in this case, we want to assert God does not exist. Then, after that, he lists the objection. Then he'll say, I answer that. And he'll state his thesis, God does exist. Then he'll give his arguments for that. And then, after he's given the arguments, then he replies to each of the counter-arguments he's raised in the first part. So in the Middle Ages, it was very, this is the way the disputes of this, where people would propose arguments and counter-arguments, were it was a very common method of proceeding, that sometimes these debates would be organized formally. Other cases, people could send in questions, or the teacher, the professor, would simply make himself available. People could ask questions to which he would have to respond, and people would send Aquinas all the various questions, and he would answer them. For example, somebody asked a question, if Christ had not performed any miracles, would Christianity still be believable? And that was an example of a question he answers, yes, it would, giving reasons for that. So the first have to ask, in considering Aquinas on politics, what was he trying to do in his writings on politics? He was, summarize it in one sentence, he was trying to modify the traditional Christian view as stated classically by St. Augustine in response to the knowledge of Aristotle's works that was available in his time. Aristotle's works had the Ethics and Politics were translated, made available in Latin translations in Aquinas's lifetime, and Aquinas wrote long commentaries on each one of these. Where by commentary, he would take every sentence in Aristotle's book and have remarks about it. So, what Aquinas modified from St. Augustine is this. St. Augustine held that because of original sin, remember, original sin is the doctrine that when Adam, the first man, and Eve had fallen, this really destroyed nature as it had previously existed. Nature was completely corrupt because of Adam's fall. The only way people were able to live at all was because of God's grace. So on this view, you really couldn't expect anything at all of value from the political society considered in itself. By accepting Christian revelation, could you overcome original sin and all the evils it had produced in human being. And St. Augustine held that government exists only because of man's sin. Had there not been original sin, then government wouldn't have been necessary. It's only because of sin that government exists. Aquinas, although, of course, he accepted original sin since it's one of the tenets, one of the dogmas of Christianity, held that original sin didn't completely corrupt nature. He said sin wounds nature, it doesn't destroy it. So Aquinas thought there was a good deal to be learned from we could learn a good deal from about politics without bringing in revelation. We could just reason by reasoning without resort to revelation. We could obtain knowledge of not only ethics and politics, but also metaphysics. He didn't entirely, in this point, he didn't entirely differ with St. Augustine. St. Augustine, after all, had philosophical proofs for the existence of God. But Aquinas was much more someone who emphasized the independent value of reason than St. Augustine did. In the Treatise on Law, Aquinas distinguishes different types of law, and it's about one of the types that I'll principally be talking about. Aquinas distinguished first what he called the eternal law, the lex aeterna. This is the pattern in sort of of God's mind. The law, the God is, remember, is according to Aquinas, is not only rational, he's subsistent reason itself. God is pure reason, pure being, which is identical to pure reason. There's nothing at all, nothing, no potentiality or irrationality in God. He's pure reason. So there's an eternal law, which is really God's mind. Then man, or human beings, the image of God. So we're able to find out by our own reason some of God's plans, some of what God has in mind. And this is natural law. Then there's also laws that are not directly deducible from reason, but are just what's called positive law. This is a term that's come down to us. We have, say, the school of legal, we talked today about legal positivists. So what's meant by positive law, it's from the word, it's just sort of law that's promulgated. We have the word in English to posit something, meaning to state something. I posit this. So a positive law is a law that is stated by someone holding authority. So it isn't something that's directly deducible by reason, then it would be part of natural law, but it's just declared by a competent authority. And there are two kinds of positive law. There's divine law, which is different from the eternal law. Divine law are specific precepts, say, that we get in Revelation telling us what to do. Something can be part of both divine law and natural law. For example, we would know in natural law, we would know that we can find out that we're not supposed to kill anyone. we're not supposed to commit murder, but this is also part of divine law because it's one of the Ten Commandments. So something can be both in divine law and positive law, but there are divine laws that are not part of positive law as well. And then there's human positive law. These are just particular legislative enactments by competent authority. Then there's also Aquinas mentioned the law of nations, which is really has elements of both natural law and positive law. This is laws that regulate that between various complete political communities. These regulate what goes on, that these communities have established between themselves to regulate what goes on. And this is the law of nations called the Jus Gentium. As I say, natural law is by far the most important for our purposes, and I want to what I want to concentrate on is what Aquinas says about natural law. How do we know it? How do we find out what are the demands of reason as they relate to morality and politics? Aquinas, like Aristotle, by whom he was much influenced, rejects the view that people in acting are motivated only by their desires. One view of action, it's one that David Hume held, and von Mises also held this view, is that we have desires for various things, and various things we want, and then reason can tell us how to achieve these desires. Say, I just want something, so then I can figure out by reason what's the best way to achieve this. Say, I want to lose weight, so I can figure out what diet should I adopt. But I can't find out through reason what to do. That depends just on what my desires are. Now, Aquinas rejects that view. One argument that shows that the reject is this: supposing someone's considering this very question, reason have any force other than as a way of helping us achieve our desires? Is there any independent, can we say something is rationally mandated regardless of how we desire it? So if we're thinking about this question, we must think it's valuable to think about this. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it. We wouldn't be engaging in this sort of reasoning. And so the very fact that we're raising the question shows that we think that knowledge is good. It's not something that, it isn't that, say, I have an independent desire. I really like to find out things, but it's just that once this question is raised, it gives me a reason to want to answer it. And the very fact that I'm engaging in the inquiry shows that I can be, that the reason itself is motivating me. Now, this knowledge then is an example of something Aquinas thought could be intrinsically motivating, but it's just one of a number of different goods that he thought were motivating in that way. So according to Aquinas, the basic precept of natural law is good is to be pursued and chosen and evil avoided. It seems hard to quarrel with that. And then the big issue is how we find out what the good is. So how do we know what are the goods we're supposed to do? And Aquinas thought that These goods, it's something like the way I just mentioned with knowledge, these goods are self-evident. He calls this uses the term per se nota. These are things that are just by examining the claim, the statement, we can see that it's true. It doesn't mean that we can't have any arguments defending it. If, say, we can come up with, say, just like the example I just gave, knowledge, we can give dialectical arguments. If somebody rejects, say, somebody says knowledge isn't good, we can show that it is, well, just that the person is engaging in the question would show that he does think it's good. So we can give arguments if anyone denies them, but the goods, they're the goods are self-evident in the sense that they're not deduced from further principles. They're just specifications of this precept of natural law that good is to be pursued and chosen and evil avoided. So one of the goods, I won't give up, a comprehensive list of them, but one of them is marriage. He holds that marriage is something that's intrinsically good. He has a very strict view of what marriage is involved. The two people, the man and the woman, are bound to each other, and that they can't separate or have any relations with anyone else. So he said, if we think about that, we'll see that it is an intrinsically good state of affairs. Then another example is truth. Aquinas has the view that it's always wrong under any circumstances to lie. It, by lying, what he means by lying, stating or implying that something is true when you believe the thing is false. So the primary badness in lying, according to Aquinas, is not that you're trying to deceive someone, but that you're being too minded or two-faced. You're at odds with yourself because you're saying one thing while believing another. So this is, according to him, it's going against the integrity of the human person if you do this. Now, of course, there are objections to the strict view that he was very familiar with. What happens, say, if someone is, there's a murderer at the door and he asks you about the location of somebody, aren't you able to lie in that? So surely you don't have to tell the person where the victim is just because he's asked you. So Aquinas says there, well, you're not obligated to reveal the truth to him, but you still are not supposed to lie. You can say something like, I know, but I'm not going to tell you. He would also accept sort of more artful statements, but that get around telling the person. But still, you can't actually tell a lie. I mean, a lie doesn't have to be in words either. For example, supposing we could think of cases where people actually done this. Supposing a politician wasn't religious, but he wanted people to think that he was, so he kept going to church services, even though where people would notice this, even though he didn't really believe anything. This would be an example, according to Aquinas, of something you couldn't licitly do, because you would be lying. Now, supposing somebody doesn't feel able to follow this very strict counsel, has he done anything very seriously wrong? Well, Aquinas says, no, it doesn't follow that because you've done something that you shouldn't, that you've committed a grave moral wrong. Say if you tell a lie, say to avoid revealing where a victim is to prospective murder, you haven't done anything really seriously wrong, but it's still, according to him, the wrong thing to do. Now, another good that he holds is respect for human life. And he holds that a private person, someone who's not in a state, someone who doesn't hold competent authority, say, as the ruler or official of a state, under no circumstances whatever can directly intend taking innocent life. Now here, very important to see what Aquinas means by intention. This is a key concept in his philosophy. The intention in action is not just the motive for something, why I'm doing it. That can be described as an intention also, but there's also an intention involved in the description of an action. For example, suppose I say I'm now giving a lecture. So in the Thomist way of viewing things, it wouldn't be right to say the action that's taking place is just that there are sounds coming out of my mouth and the intention is just that I'm thinking I want to give a lecture, and so this is connected with these, joined with these physical sounds. The intention, the description of the action would not be just physical sounds are coming out. The description of the action would be I'm giving a lecture. That would be called the intention in the action. And then there's further intention, but why am I giving the lecture? We could have further intention, why am I doing that? And then we could have possibly further intention. We could have a whole nested series of intentions. But the important thing is the intention is what's involved in the description of the act that I'm doing. There's a very important book that developed the Aquinas' concepts that are very influential in modern philosophy by Elizabeth Anscombe that came out in 1957. This is the best work to read on intention if you really want to get a good grasp of what Aquinas had in mind. So, as I say, Aquinas held that a private person can never intentionally intend the death of an innocent person. Can never directly intend the death of anyone. Not just an innocent person, but anyone. So, again, let's imagine that, say, someone is going to murder you. Does this mean that you can't resist at all? No, not at all. You can resist. In fact, you can even use force that you know will very likely result in the person's death. But it's just that you can't directly intend the person's death. So the description of your action would be resisting the assault on me. It wouldn't be that I want to kill this person. I want to. So you might say, well, what's the difference in practice? Well, one way this could come about is suppose there were some means of stopping the person without killing him, then you would have to do that rather than kill him. So what the key here is that the description of the action, the direct, your direct intention, has to be, can never be to kill anyone, even in self-defense. That if you're a private person, Aquinas held, on the contrary, the competent government authorities can directly intend to kill people. For example, in capital punishment or in war, you can directly intend to kill people. See, there people in war would be who are soldiers who are following the orders of the competent authority could directly intend someone's death. So we have then, according to Aquinas, there are various human goods that we have reason to adopt. And one point at which he's a little different from Aristotle, Aristotle, you remember, is asked the question, how can, each person will be asking, how can I lead the best life? What is the best life? Now, Aquinas is also asked the same question. He holds that people are properly have self-love. Each person wants his own good. However, according to Aquinas, if something is a human good, in the sense I've explained, it's one of these goods, you have a reason to do it, to seek it, or to avoid the evil, even if the good or evil has nothing to do with you personally. So, say, if I see I could help you in some way that falls under one of these class of human good, I would have a reason to do it, even if I'm not in any special relationship with you, even if it wouldn't particularly benefit me to help you. I still have a reason to do it. And we'll see how this comes out when I mention Aquinas' views on property a little later. So then everyone then has this motivation to try to achieve the human goods and avoid the evil. But then we have a question, well, how, you have all sorts of goods. How do you decide which ones to pursue? Well, Aquinas holds that sort of the basic way we decide this, we just follow the precept in the Bible, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. So we have, it's we sort of, by following that, we sort of never will act against any of these basic human goods, and we're able to act in a kind of systematic way just by pursuing that path, by trying to love our neighbor as ourselves. We're trying to achieve the basic human goods. Now, before turning from this topic of Aquinas' moral theory and going on to some of the political applications, I should mention there's a big dispute among contemporary scholars of Aquinas and contemporary Thomists on a particular point in Aquinas' ethics. And that is, when I gave this basic precept of natural law, good is to be pursued and chosen, evil avoided, is this something that's deducible from human nature? Is it that we say we can see just by thinking about what the nature of human beings is that this precept follows and all the other goods that are constituent parts of the human good follow from that? Or is it an independent principle, something that's just not derivable from human nature? So the traditional view, which is defended by Ralph McInerney, has a number of books on Aquinas, including one called Ethica Thomistica, is that Aquinas holds that we get the basic precept of natural law by deriving it from human nature. Henry Veitch, who was a very good Aristotelian and Thomist, philosopher has the same view, but there's a competing interpretation that was there was an important article by a philosopher named Germain Grisey. It came out in 1965, and he's allied with the Oxford legal philosopher John Finnis, and they say, no, this is altogether wrong. Aquinas didn't think you could derive precept of ethics, which is a statement telling you what to do. Remember, good is to be pursued and chosen, evil avoided. That's a statement. But ought statement. It isn't a statement, at least related to an ought statement, not a strict statement of ought. But it's not a factual statement. It's a statement what you ought to do. So they say, no, Aquinas didn't think that such a statement was deducible from human nature. It's independently postulated. Now, I think one reason they hold this view is that they accept the argument given famously by David Hume that you can't derive statements about what we ought to do just from descriptive statements about what is the case. So they say, oh, well, Aquinas wasn't guilty of this fallacy. No, he didn't do this. And the other group, the more traditional group, think it isn't a fallacy, so there's no reason to try to say that Aquinas didn't commit it. He did think you could deduce this basic principle of natural law from human nature, and there's nothing the matter with that. So I should mention also Finnis's views. He has a very important book just called Aquinas, where he discusses his legal and political theory. He gives a very elaborate account of his views on the matter. I'm inclined to think myself the traditional interpretation is better the argument, but it is important to realize that there are these great two main competing interpretations, and the fight between them has been going on for a long time. If you're interested in that controversy, there's a book by Russell Hittinger called The Critique of the New Natural Law Theory that came out, I think, around 1993 or so. The views that Aquinas held on moral theory that I tried to explain have very direct implications for politics. If there are these basic human goods, it follows, according to Aquinas, that there are things that it's never permissible to do to anybody. For example, to kill the person or to steal property from him that's justly his. We'll see what's involved in, as I say, in Aquinas' views on property, but later, it's never right to be involved in an adulterous relationship with someone that the person is married to. So we have, according to Aquinas, everyone has certain basic rights, and Aquinas says everyone is born free and equal. Now, some people have objected. They say, oh, you can't say that Aquinas had the notion of rights at all. I mentioned people said that about Aristotle also, and as I mentioned in my last lecture, Fred Miller and others have said, no, they're wrong. Aristotle did have a notion of rights. And I think similarly, we can say here Aquinas clearly did have the notion of rights. Because we can see this, he says, he defines justice as the firm resolve to give to everyone what is his. And he says sometimes to give to everyone what is his by right, using the term jus. So he this clearly, in the context he's using, clearly indicates that people do have... Right, oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Oh, it didn't. Let's get it up here. Ah. Good, that would violate Aquinas' posthumous rights if you hadn't noticed that. All right, so everyone does have this, the basic rights, but in order to secure, oh, I should say also, on these rights, according to Aquinas, they don't altogether rule out, oddly enough, they don't altogether rule out slavery. No one, according to him, is a slave by nature. He rejects what Aristotle says, that there are some people who are slaves by nature. However, you can sell yourself into servitude. I guess he's read Walter Block on this issue. So you can sell yourself into servitude. However, it's very strictly limited, if you do that, what can be done to you. For example, the owner would have no authority because no one has this other than the rulers, those in authority, to impose anything more than minor punishments. Also, you couldn't be forbidden from marrying someone or compelled to marry someone, and you had the right to work on your own to provide for your family. In fact, if a master wanted you to do something and you thought it, you were a slave and you thought it would interfere with your needed work to help your own family, you could refuse to do the work. So the term for slave actually is probably, it's doubtful whether this can be really translated as slave. Probably it's more of a servant relationship, where you, although you couldn't leave voluntarily if you sold yourself into such thing, but they're very strict restrictions. So it's not at all say slavery in America or anything like that. It's a much more limited sort of thing. So then again, so everyone has these basic rights, but like Aristotle, Aquinas thinks there's a people, in order to live well, must be part of a complete community. They can't just secure their needs just by having a group of families or households get together. They have to form part of some larger group. Unlike Aristotle, Aquinas isn't very particular about the size of the group. Sometimes he refers, or it can be a city-state, a polis, as in the classical Greece, but it doesn't have to be. Sometimes he refers, uses the same term, civitas, to mean not only a city, but a much larger entity, such as a province or a country. It doesn't really matter to him. For the Greeks, for Aristotle and Plato, it definitely did. The size of the city definitely did matter. Aristotle holds that a city shouldn't be too large. And in fact, one of the reasons he thinks that the best city can regulate population is to regulate certain reproductive issues, prevent population from getting too large. And similarly, Plato, in his description of the city in the Laws, limits, he says the city should be composed of, I think, something like 5,040 households. He wants this exact number. So Aquinas doesn't hold this view. Now, then, I think the key point, though, once we have Aquinas wants this complete community, is this is, I think, one reason for agreeing with the great classical liberal historian Lord Acton that Aquinas was the first Whig, is that Aquinas holds that the complete community is concerned only with external actions and behavior. Say, if what the object of the complete community is to provide peace and order. Aquinas quotes the beautiful definition of St. Augustine that peace is the tranquility of order. So what the basic idea is that people, in order to live well, have to coordinate their actions in some way. And Aquinas thought he didn't have the Hayekian insight that order can emerge spontaneously. He thought that if you have various ways of coordinating action, you need someone in authority to set out how the order is to be done. You need to have the someone deciding. Suppose we want to have a group of people living together. We need to decide, say, how they're to coordinate their actions. And this process by which the state decides what to do, this process of legislation, Aquinas calls this determination. He uses the term determinatio. This is where you would have a choice of various ways to achieve something. You have to pick one. Say we're deciding. Imagine we've sometimes done at this instant. We have to have a picture of everyone in the group. We have to somehow. Someone has to decide how the people are going to be arranged in the picture. There are various ways one could do it, but we have to pick one of these, and so. This process of deciding where you have a choice of which way to do it, it's called determinatio. But as I say, it concerns only external action. Say, if this, unlike Aristotle, who holds that the purpose of the city-state is to promote virtue, Aquinas thinks you can promote virtue only as it relates to external actions. He doesn't take this in a way that contemporary libertarians would be completely comfortable with. For example, he holds that, because children need to be educated in a certain way, you could prevent pornography, because this would have a bad effect on children, and this would interfere with the way people interacted in society. But say you couldn't prohibit somebody from looking at pornographic materials by himself if he somehow got hold of them. You couldn't interfere with purely private vices. So the borderline isn't very clear, but he holds something like, as we'll see later, John Stuart Mill holds, that if there's something that's purely self-regarding, the state can't interfere with it. And this applies also to religion, even though, of course, he thinks that everyone should be a member of the, join the Catholic Church and accept its doctrines. The state doesn't have the right to force people to accept the true faith. He makes an exception to this for people who are continued heretics. I won't go into his argument for that in case someone wants to ask a question about it. I could, but basically he holds that if someone is continued in heresy after a number of warnings, then he's really guilty of a breach of promise. So he can be given over to the state for execution. That's really, I think, is inconsistent with the main tenor of Aquinas' discussion. Now, a question that I think will be of interest to us, all libertarians, would be, what does Aquinas, how does this view of Aquinas held about rights and the nature of state, what is the, how does this relate to property? How does this affect, what are his views on right to acquire property? He holds that the earth was originally given to everyone in common. However, this doesn't exclude at all people from acquiring property for themselves. Quite the contrary, he thinks that the way people make the earth, parts of the earth available for common use is just by acquiring it for their own use. Say, if you possess some property, then you produce something and you put various products on the market. So just what you're doing is making the property available to others. This is how you make the property available. And he thinks that this is much better way of doing things than letting property just remain in common, because you think people, I think very rightly, that people would be interested much more in producing with what they own themselves than just trying to make do by taking something from a common store. So he had was very definitely aware of the division of labor and the need for people to integrate their economic activities. Now he divided. He didn't, though, have any view, say as Locke and later libertarians have held that you acquire property by mixing your labor with the property. It wasn't any particular relationship between the person and unowned property that would give you the property. It was just that you were somehow putting it into use that gave you the rights to it. Now, according to him, there, when we think about property, there are really three classes of property. First is what you need for your absolute necessity. You couldn't live without this property, without getting this particular item. Now, if there's a matter, something that's absolutely necessary for you to have, Aquinas holds that you can take it. No one has the right to withhold it from you. Well, there's an obvious, what if somebody else needs the same item is necessary for him to live? Then Aquinas says, well, then you don't really have any solution. There's no definite solution to that, but a bit like Rand on emergency ethics. But again, if something is absolutely necessary, you can take it. Now, the second class is property that you need to fulfill your responsibilities. This would include materials, items such as securing the education for your members of your household, or enabling people in your household to make a living, or conducting your business, your legitimate business, or paying your debts. And here Aquinas thinks this is it's reasonable. You're entitled to hold this property. And if you know that somebody else needs some of this property for his absolute necessity, you're not obligated to give it to him. He can take it if he can, but you don't have to offer it to him. You're entitled to keep what you need for your absolute necessity. Then the third class property is superfluous items. That's things that you don't need for either the first two. And here Aquinas holds that you don't have any right over these things at all. You really should give it to the poor. You don't have any right to these. However, as I mentioned, he does hold that investment is a legitimate form of activity. So he wouldn't favor any policy, say, that would tax businesses so that they'd have to lose all their profits and give them to the poor, because this would be not their superfluous property, but would be part of their property that they were able to hold, because it would be ones on one of their, they would be fulfilling their reasonable obligation, namely to promote their own business. Now, while we're on the subject of economics, I should say something about Aquinas' views on price and usury. Murray Rothbard, in the first volume of his History of Economic Thought, has a characteristically good discussion of this point, but I'll say a few additional things, or some one perspective slightly different from what you, the treatment you'll get in that book, which everyone needs to consult. Aquinas held, here he was following Aristotle, who, when Aristotle discusses what he calls reciprocal justice, that in an exchange, if I trade something with you, I trade, say, apples for oranges, there has to be an equality, and the equality is one where the really, where the, based on need, the price has to correspond to need in some way. It isn't entirely clear how this is to be done, but the way, what Aquinas thought was that really the measure of need is, in most circumstances, the going market rate for a good. So basically he held that in an exchange, you were acting legitimately if you sold or bought at the market price. Now, supposing you say you were selling something and you knew that the price of the what you were selling was going to go down very soon, are you obligated to tell the buyer about this, or can you sell him the good at the going rate? According to Aquinas, you don't have to tell the person, you can sell at the going rate. However, suppose you had a case where someone, say, really wants something. Someone has always wanted a copy of my book on Marx, and he's willing to pay $500 for it, which is somewhat above the market price. Can the seller say, okay, fine, I accept your offer of $500 for it? Aquinas says, no, he can't do that. He has to sell it at the going price. Now, the other interesting economic issue involves interest on money. And here, again, Aquinas followed Aristotle. Aquinas thought there was a problem in getting interest on a loan, in that he said there are some goods where you can distinguish between the good itself and the use of the good. For example, suppose I rent an apartment from someone, then I'm paying for the use of the apartment, but the apartment is, I can distinguish that from owning the apartment. It's intelligent, makes sense to say, I'm just using the building, the apartment, but the owner of the apartment retains his ownership. He's just letting me use it. But there are other goods where this isn't true. For example, suppose you consider wine. Well, you can't. When you buy wine, you're not buying both the bottle of wine and the use of the wine. Just you're using, when you buy it, you're just, you drink it, you've used up the good, there's nothing left. You couldn't say, okay, I'm just paying for the use of the wine, now I'm going to return the actual wine to the owner. There is nothing to return. So Aquinas thinks money is like wine in this respect. When you're using money, there's nothing, there's no such thing as having the owning the money, as using the money but not owning it. If someone loans you money, then if you use it, that's all there is to it. There's no money left that you can still return. So if there's a charge for interest, then in effect Aquinas thinks you're being charged twice. You're being asked to pay back the original money plus a separate amount for the use of the money. So he said this is obviously illicit. I think it's interesting to try to figure out what exactly is wrong with this argument. I think, as I see it, the basic fallacy is that Aquinas is assuming that if you're paying back the money, say that what you would have to pay back is the exact sum of money that you borrowed. This would certainly make sense if we just considered things in an example like this. Suppose I say how much I have a $20 bill in my wallet. How much money will you give me for it? You wouldn't give me more than $20 and I wouldn't sell it to you for less than $20. It would be pointless. It would just be an exchange of $20 for $20. But if there were a question, how much money will you give me in 6 months if I give you $20? It doesn't follow at all that just getting back the money would mean the price of the money would be $20. Aquinas is just assuming that the value of the good is always the same. He's not taking account of the time preference. So if you do take account of the time preference and you really considered it as different goods, there would be no particular reason to think that you wanted the price of $20 6 months from now would be $20, just as you would not know, say, for any two goods like apples and oranges, what the correct ratio is. This would be just something that would depend on the market price. So interest doesn't involve, as Aquinas thought, this double charge. Last issue I want to discuss in Aquinas' theory is, I think, one that's certainly very relevant for us today in contemporary America: his views on just war. Now, Aquinas developed views of St. Augustine, but had more to say on it than St. Augustine did. And according to Aquinas, there are three conditions for a just war. And it's the third of these conditions that I want to stress the most, because this is the one I think has great relevance for us today. Now, the first one is that he thought that the war has to be declared by someone holding authority. You can't have private wars. Remember, one feature in Aquinas' theory is that the rulers, those who have legitimate rule, have certain powers that private people don't have. Remember, a private person can never directly intend the death of anyone, but those holding public authority can, because one reason for this is that they're able, according to him, to be impartial. They say a private person, say, was trying to decide when to use deadly force directly, would be likely to make mistakes in his own favor, but someone who's a competent authority would be able to avoid this. So the war has to be declared by competent authority. Then the second requirement is that it has to be for a just cause. This doesn't have to be self-defense, but there has to be some injury, that some violation of the natural law that is the state is trying to rectify. Now, the third one, as I think is to say the key one, is the war has to be waged with the right intention. So you can only have a legitimate war if your intention is to rectify whatever the problem was that led to the just cause. Say, if you had some other intention as well, that would knock out the war entirely. Or say, if you, in the conduct of the war, violated the proper rules, say, if you attacked someone who was innocent directly, that's something no one can ever do, that would invalidate the war entirely. So I think, say, if we looked at the applied this to the Iraq war today, we could see very readily that would be out altogether because it wouldn't be waged with the right intention. I won't go into any of the direct political application, but again, there's an excellent essay by Elizabeth Anscombe in her collected philosophical papers, volume 3, where she applies this view to various, she applies it to origins of World War II and U.S. policy in that war. So she shows that this Thomas doctrine has very strict implications. In fact, one authority on the Aquinas, Cardinal Charles Journet said, if we follow the just war teaching, there would only be a handful of wars in human history that would turn out to be justified. Now, the last topic I want to mention is, I mentioned on how, some of Aquinas' views on what the proper course of conduct for the government is, but what about, what did he actually think the structure of the government should be like? What is the best form of government? Here he says that ideally, kingship, ruled by one person, is the best, if not corrupt, if it isn't corrupted. But he thinks it very likely will be corrupted. So in practice, a mixed form of government is best. For example, say one where there was a monarch, but there's also an aristocratic element. Say there's a group of people who are advising, close advisors of the king that he consults before deciding on policies. And also there's a popular element. Say people can have chance to elect some of the advisors, or even the chance to elect who even have elect the monarch, although Aquinas certainly didn't require that. And he also makes a distinction, besides this one, between how many are ruling, whether you have kingship or not. He makes a distinction between what he calls regal rule. This is not the same as kingship. It's just a particular class, a type of rule, and political rule. Regal rule is where the ruler, whoever it is limited only by the natural law. There aren't constitutional limits on the power of the government. For example, the contemporary British government is being a case of regal rule because Parliament really can pass any legislation it wants. There's no constitutional limit to what the Parliament can do. There's certainly customary limits if that would be considered very bad, very strange if the Parliament were to violate them. But the Parliament would technically have the power to do that. And then the political rule is where government has their limits to what the government can do that are put in, that are explicitly part of the structure of the government. Say in our government, although these aren't always observed in practice, say we have, say, the rule that only Congress can declare war, the president can't do it. So if that limit were observed, that would be certainly a limit on the president, is it not? It's a limit put in by the constitution. So it would be part of political rule. Even in the regal rule, though, the ruler can't do anything at all that he wants that's consistent with natural law. One thing that he's limited is that he has to follow his own laws. He can't exempt himself from his own laws, because this, in addition to the power of coercion that a law has, according to Aquinas, a law also tells people guides people what to do. So if the ruler violated his own laws, this would confuse people. So he can't do that. And then and the last thing I'll say, and this is again a reason that Lord Acton thought that Aquinas was the first Whig, this is the reason he gave, is that he holds that if the government doesn't follow the proper course, if it violates people's rights, you have the right to disobey and in some cases to revolt against the government if they're gross violations of people's rights. However, you need to take account in considering whether to revolt or even possibly to kill the tyrant. You have to take account of the possible bad effects this would have. So there might be cases where, say, a government is violating people's rights, but trying to overthrow it would cause a great deal of trouble, and it would result in more disorder than it's worth to correct the government. So we see here, I think, in conclusion, we can see how Aquinas developed some of the basic ideas of Aristotle on the complete political community, but he had more clearly than Aristotle did a notion of individual rights and the limits on the power of the state. So I think we have some time for questions, objections. Rodney.
One of the early fathers of the church, it might have been Athanasius, one of those guys, was fleeing from some soldiers who were after him for some reason, and they came across him and didn't recognize him, and they asked him, is Athanasius around him?
Yes, he says he's very near.
And he said, he's not far distant, you've got a good chance of catching him, or something like that. And they said, oh, thanks, and rushed off. The question is, does that pass Aquinas's scruples?
The question was, in the example where St. Athanasius was being pursued, and he said, in response to the pursuers, they asked him, do you know where Athanasius is? And he said, he's not far off. And then they went on rowing right by. Question is, would this pass Aquinas' test? Yes, I think it would, because here it isn't that. Remember, for Aquinas, the lying isn't that you're intending to deceive the person. It's that you're saying something that you know to be false. And what he's saying is perfectly true. The person isn't far off. And similarly, he gives the example, supposing soldiers in battle, the general decides on a retreat in order to get the enemy to advance, and then he comes in and attacks them. That's perfectly all right, because all you've done is order the retreat. If the enemy wants to conclude you're in full retreat, that's their problem. All you've done is withdraw your forces. That's perfectly all right. So the key question is, just are you saying something that, while you believe, or are you doing something that implies that you hold something to be true while really believing it to be false? It doesn't have to be in words. Aquinas says you can lie, say, with the nod of a finger. So, again, the key question is truth rather than deception. Dan?
One of the things that came up with the Iraq War and the idea of lying is that the president gave a speech in which he had 14 words regarding
D'Amico may be a serial killer, and that person then goes and relates to the authorities, Dan D'Amico is a serial killer. Where is it? Does Aquinas have a problem with a thing like that where you turn uncertainty into certainty? That also applies to
The question was, in, say, a case where someone has uncertain information and treats it as a certainty. For example, President Bush said there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. His defenders say he wasn't lying because that he was just basing himself on certain intelligence reports that were uncertain. He didn't say they were uncertain. Would this count as a lie in Aquinas' sense? I think there the question, key question would be, what does the person himself believe to be true? When you assert something, asserting something is claiming that it's the case, claiming that it's true. So if in fact Bush believed that it fell short of truth, it was just there was some possibility there were weapons there, I think it would be a lie because his real belief, the lie doesn't, to lie or to say what you believe to be, to say something is true that you believe to be false, it doesn't have to be the contradictory, you don't have to believe the contradictory of what you assert. It's just you have failed to believe what you actually assert. So for chronological reasons, he didn't discuss that actual case, so I can't really say. Michael?
When you described how Aquinas differs from the way we behave with credit card companies, that is, we expect that if we borrow borrow money, we are going to pay for the privilege of getting it now rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think Aquinas thought differently about it than the way we do?
I would probably he hadn't really had the concept of time preference, which is something that came into economics only later. But I think he took it. I mean, it's a very seems very obvious that something like $20 is $20. How could you say that $20 now is a different good from $20 6 months from now? They're still the same good. So I think it took quite a bit of, it was a great insight when people saw that this wasn't the case. Economics wasn't the subject that Aquinas was particularly done an enormous amount of original work, and it was one he knew quite a bit about it. But I mean, that wasn't an area where he thought extremely deeply on his own, unlike most subjects that he covered. Yes, Tom?
This is highly speculative, but on the subject of usury, I spoke to our mutual friend, Father Sadowski, about this.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I actually asked Father because I was in the middle of doing some of my own writing on the subject, taking our position on interest and interest. And I remember saying to Father that I can already hear my detractors saying, "Well, you think you know more than Thomas Aquinas on this subject?" And Father very serenely replied, "Well, on this matter, you do."
Question was Father James Sadowski suggested that perhaps Aquinas really in his heart of hearts didn't believe fully in the church's doctrine of usury, but he held he had to defend it because that was the official position. Well, that's an interesting idea. One thing possibly we could say in favor of that is Aquinas does hold that a lender can be compensated for his loss in lending the money. In this respect, like supposing the lender was going to invest in a business, had he not loaned the money, he would have made money on that. Then he can charge for what he would have made. However, he can't say, well, I was going to invest in, say, this, I would have made $1 million in this, so I can charge you this rate. He has to take account of the speculative character. He can only sort of, if he thinks there's a chance he could have made the money, he has to discount for that. He can't just say, I was going to get this profit. He has to take account that he might not have gotten it. And that has to be considered in his decision. Also, Aquinas said he couldn't say, well, if I hadn't loaned the money to you, I would have loaned it to somebody else, so I would have made profit on that. That would be rather circular reasoning. Now, on the question of why, one thing I should mention when you say this raises the question, was Aquinas, if Aquinas did hold that, would he have been lying? I should mention in the talk, as usual, there's a Straussian interpretation of Aquinas. Now, this one is not held by all or even most Strauss. It's more in the oral tradition. In fact, if you look at the chapter on Aquinas in the basic Straussian textbook, History of Political Philosophy, edited by Strauss and Joseph Cropsey, the chapter on Aquinas is by Father Ernest Fortin, who was an extremely good scholar, and it gives a very standard view of Aquinas. I recommend this, but there's in the oral tradition, there's some people, that I think there's people who hold this, that Aquinas was really a secret atheist, didn't believe any of this stuff. Say, when he says in the Summa, it seems there is no God, that was what his real view was. He wasn't just giving the objection, but that was what he really held. I must say I don't find that altogether plausible.
Ayn Rand was tempted by that interpretation.
Pardon me?
Ayn Rand said she was tempted by that interpretation.
Oh,
she didn't say she actually felt
it. Oh, I guess, but I guess that, of course, it doesn't follow she was a Strauss. Yeah.
Also on the usury question, if I'm remembering correctly, Aristotle employed this argument saying that because money is barren, it doesn't multiply itself, reproduce itself, it's illegitimate to demand usury because then that's a violation of the nature of the thing. Does Aquinas also employ that argument, or does he rely mainly on this use versus ownership?
I think he quotes the Aristotle. I think he relies mainly on his own argument. The question was, does Aquinas use Aristotle's point against usury, that when Aristotle says money is barren? Well, I think probably a better answer would be he regards his argument really as a counter explanation of what Aristotle meant by that. It's not, after all, it's not altogether clear what Aristotle means by saying money is barren. It's somewhat of a metaphor. So I think what Aquinas is doing is really explaining what this means. Anybody else? All right, well, thanks very much. Thank you.